Senator Javits, can I go back to the question you were asking a minute ago?
Sure.
You said a few minutes ago that this would apply 1/7 of the total of those unemployed. What about the other 6/7?
Well, they're on unemployment compensation, and undoubtedly will have to continue to be unless you want them to go on welfare, which would be terribly debilitating and very much against the interests of the country. And we have always maintained a certain concept of proportion about the relationship of public service jobs to the adequate number of unemployed. And this proportion is the proportion that Senator Williams and I are contending.
In addition, there is emergency housing legislation that is underway both in the House and the Senate that would be a stimulant to residential home building for middle-income people. There's every indication that that legislation, and it deals with partial support on the mortgage interest, will have early passage here. This could mean a significant dent in the unemployment of construction workers.
Senators, if I could, you want
to say? Well, just one thing. My staff has given me a note, which I think you should understand. When you have a public service job, you don't draw unemployment compensation. And the tax and other effects of having a job, even though it's a public service job, induce us to estimate that the net cost to the federal government is about 50% of the $7,800, and that therefore it differs in that respect from unemployment compensation.
Senator, if I could, both of you, want to prep your staff to get clear the budgetary numbers here. First of all, the administration at present has a program for this fiscal year of 250,000 public service jobs. That's correct.
Its program is actually for 166,000. That
Congress
is at $1.3 billion.
At $1.3 billion.
That's right. That's what they put it. That is, the administration has put it at $1.3 billion. You'll find that in the press release, analyzed. Right now, we are expending at the rate of provision for 250,000 public service jobs in round figures. And the question is, shall we go higher, and that's why we seek an authorization for 1 million, shall we go higher or shall we stay with the budgetary figure? And Senator Williams and I are calling for a quantum jump in that figure, and I estimated that quantum jump in immediate money at adding at least $1 billion to $1.3 billion.
Now, is the administration or labor giving an indication of current figures? How many of these jobs have been filled in what period of time?
There was a great lag in filling these jobs, but the lag is being made up now very, very rapidly. We had a lag in New York, etc. And the estimate of 250,000 is our estimate of what is actually employed
on
now.
The job.
Right.
Yes. So let's go back to that quantum jump there. If this proposal is taken to its fullest by June 30, 76.
Yeah. By June 30, 77, that's 2 years? Or 76.
76.
Right.
You would have, instead of $1 billion, though, you would have allowed 7.8 million.
Well, that's assuming that you're... it isn't even that. It would be instead of 2.5 billion in round figures. You see, the administration's calling for $1.3 billion.
Right.
I say in the ballpark figure of an added billion
right away.
So let's say in round figures, 2.5 billion. If you did go to the full 1 million public service jobs, and I doubt that you will,
No. You
would have hit 7.8 billion. My guess is that your present figure would indicate about a doubling of where you are now.
And you would use that up to 7.8 as needed and if the situation
warrants. That's correct.
Warrants.
That's correct.
Yes.
That's
over
correct.
The period
That's correct. But taking the past history of these appropriations, if you authorized for 1 million, you'd probably be actually getting about 0.5 million.
Senator Javits, your colleague, Senator Buckley, has expressed concern about this program because he says too many of the jobs may go to leaf rakers instead of people who are employed in meaningful and needed positions such as improving the road.
Well, now, I'm all with the idea of utilizing jobs to improve the railroads and to improve housing. As Senator Williams has just said, And I join with Senator Buckley or any other senator in that. But these jobs, and that's the virtue of this program, have now been proven not to go to leaf rakers. The fact is that the proportion which is going into education and health and comparable services, I'm just trying to find it here, it's in this really somewhere, has already been proven as high, and therefore that this program has actually proved up. We'll give you those percentages. Is Ms. Scales here?
John? Yes, sir.
Oh, what are those percentages?
Education, for example, is 20%.
Well, give us all of them.
Yes.
Well, he's getting that, could I make a comment here? This program is not structured so that it could be used in a way that I wish we could use it. But recall during, some will recall, I guess there are only a couple of us here, Jack, that will recall, one of the programs of the Depression was the Civilian Conservation Corps, or the CCC. This was not leaf raking, but it was basic conservation. And I know one of the states that prospered most and still prospers from the work of unemployed young people back in the 30s was the state of New York. The Adirondack Mountains still are protected by the fire breaks made by the young men back in the early 30s. This program, because of its structuring with prime sponsors, wouldn't lend itself to rural conservation, and yet it's something I should think, I believe we should think of, particularly in terms of unemployed youth employment in public service.
Well, I'll give you the breakdown, gentlemen. We've now had experience for about 4 years since the Emergency Employment Act of 1971 with public service employment. The record shows that of the number so employed, 22% have gone into public works and transportation. Education, 20%. Law enforcement, 12%. Health and hospital services, 9%. Parks and recreation, 8%. Social services, 6%. Environmental protection, 4%. Fire protection, 2%. And other categories, including general administration, 17%. So the program commends itself because we've actually worked with it and worked out the bugs and have proven it. In addition, under the program as it's been ongoing up to now, a very large proportion of those who had public service jobs, which at the maximum were limited to 2 years and are now limited to 1 year, have gone into other permanent public or private employment. Our figures show as high as 82% after 1 year from leaving the public service employment job. Now, that may not be repeated because we're in a difficult unemployment situation, but it certainly shows a quality in the program as now administered, which lends itself to high efficiency in the way in which these jobs are utilized. And I repeat, and I'm sure Senator Williams would feel the same way, that in terms of railroad maintenance, mass transit, etc., we would be very pleased to see labor stimulated and diverted in those areas. It's tremendously constructive for the country. But the slots are not yet available for those purposes, while these that I have referred to are.
Senator Javits, can you break down for us the kind of support this bill seems to have on this side of the House, on the Capitol? Can you give us a broad timetable for passage and implementation?
Well, I would feel that implementation could be very prompt. We figured on the last bill last year that implementation began within 30 days after appropriation. And you could see that from the storm raised in New York about non-use and then how quickly use improved very materially. As the passage, if Chairman Williams, as he has just stated, will give us the necessary hearing, I would say within the next 2 months there should be action upon a measure like this. Would that be a good
idea? Yes, it certainly could be done.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.
Pete, thank you. I talked to Gail on the phone. He said he would come. He said he would come.
revalidate the American doctrine of equal justice under law. Third, we have to learn the lessons of what I've called the imperial presidency and restore the constitutional balance between the executive and the Congress that the founders of our nation envisioned. We must find the way to a lasting peace in the world and reduce the back-breaking burden of nuclear and other armaments. And we must mitigate the overhanging danger of arms races by seeking a rule of law over the rule of force. And beyond everything else, we have to reverse the serious erosion of public confidence in our institutions, both public and private, and remove the dangers that this erosion of confidence implies for tranquility, freedom, and prosperity in the United States. Now, through all the years of my public career, since World War II, public service has meant to me an honorable profession with great capacity for remedying injustice and contributing to social justice, well-being, and peace. And I'm deeply troubled by the erosion of public confidence in our institutions and feel it my duty to give such additional years as are vouchsafed to me in the effort to deal with the causes of that erosion and to start us on the road back to rebuilding these institutions and restoring public confidence in them. Now, I've enjoyed my service in the Senate, both in the day-to-day development of the laws, of which I've been an integral part, and particularly in the major initiatives that I've been privileged to offer during my present Senate term. These include the War Powers Resolution passed over the President's veto, for the first time assuring that no president can commit us to war without the concurrence of the Congress. They include also wage and price stabilization, pension and welfare fund reform, an enormous revolution for 35 million American workers, which will become law within the next few months. Minimum wage, already law, the development of national health insurance, the reform of workmen's compensation, and the various education programs, including those for adults, for gifted and talented children, for college and part-time students, and for the handicapped. And, of course, these initiatives have been preceded by others in preceding terms, such as the establishment of the National Endowment for the Arts, extensive legislation on civil rights, jobs, job training, housing, and health, including the establishment of the National Heart Disease Institute and small business. So that I have those things behind me and in this term, and I have also some very definite initiatives on the drawing board for the future. For one, the National Institutions Act, endeavoring to fortify the position of the Congress and give it some terms of equality with the president. And the second, profit sharing and stock ownership for workers, which will come as a succeeding step for me in the total effort to deal with the alienation of the American worker, one of the big problems of our system. Now, in connection with announcing my candidacy, I wish to announce also that the chairman of my campaign will be your own congressman. I'm very honored that Howard Robeson, Dean of the New York Republican delegation, has undertaken the chairmanship of my reelection campaign. The campaign manager for me will be my longtime associate, former law partner while I was in the practice of the law, and my first assistant when I was Attorney General, John Trubin of New York, who is also here, John. And the director of the campaign and the day-to-day operation of it will be Judd Somer, who has left the job as the state director of Senate activities in New York in order to assume the directorship of the campaign. Congressman Robeson has issued a statement. As you know, he's busy today in Washington marking up an appropriations bill, so he couldn't be here, and I have that statement available. And I'd like to express my great thanks to Doris Brooks, who is here for the Broome County organization, and Fran Leavenworth, who's here for the organization right next door, for coming out to help me in respect of this announcement. Now, gentlemen, your question.
Senator, you said that you you hope to be able to rebuild confidence in government. How would you go about doing that?
Well, I think I mentioned, of course, worker alienation with the system. And there I really have a great many things going. I've mentioned pension and welfare fund reform. The reform of workmen's compensation systems, even our own, is really behind the times, is gaining ground, and I'm confident I can put that through. And the comprehensive job training bill, which I got passed not so many months ago, is a milestone in that regard. In addition, as I say, I'm coming up with legislation dealing with profit sharing by workers, giving them a piece of the action, which is, I think, a critically important element in this network of activities. Also, I was one of the authors of the so-called OSHA, that is the Safety and Health Administration of the United States for workers in their various plants. And of course, the overriding moral issue is Watergate. And it is my judgment that as a lawyer of great experience and a former prosecutor, having been Attorney General of the state, I can be of enormous service as this issue develops. And I have already, contributed strongly to, one, the expedition with which Congress will handle it, and two, the fairness with which Congress will handle it in terms of the American system. And just to save time, I might just well detail that. One, I joined at the very beginning in the Senate resolution within the first few days to appoint the Watergate Committee, and also in the various measures to get full information for that committee. Second, I have worked hard to urge the House to act quickly as essential to the stability of the country. My date was May 15th. That obviously is past, but I have worked very hard at influencing members of the House in that regard and continue to do so. Third, I have, I believe and have expressed my belief with all the prestige I command that the House committee handling the impeachments entitled everything the president's got, and that in an impeachment proceedings, that he cannot invoke an executive privilege. He has to leave it to the House committee itself to determine what it will or will not make public. But he must give them everything they ask for. And fourth, I've given my interpretation of the law, which will be the law of the case for us, that we don't have to find the president guilty of a crime beyond a reasonable doubt. But the Constitution means that we must find him immorally unworthy of continuing as President of the United States, and that is the proper constitutional test. And finally, I've stated my view that if he is impeached, we don't know anything about that yet, that he should lay down the powers of the office and turn them over to Vice President Ford until the Senate decides, and that is a perfectly feasible way in which to deal with his problems. Now, the resignation question has seemed to me to be the very easy way out. That's why I have not used it, because you can't make a president resign. If he wishes to, he will. If he doesn't wish to, he won't. In addition, it tends to drain us of our resolution to go ahead with the proceedings if the only thing we have to say is resign. And finally, I think it very materially harms his ability to continue to execute his powers in the office. And he is a president. He's got to continue to be a president.
And there's no substitute for the president, except another president. So for all of those reasons, I have not engaged in what I call the sterile act of just asking him to resign, which means nothing. Now, if he is impeached, that's another matter. Then he should lay down his duties under the 25th Amendment.
Carry on this Watergate situation here for a moment. Some Republicans have been defeated already in the primary in the United States.
Everyone, this is Senator Javits with a report to the people of the state of New York. First, I'd like to comment on a few issues. The most pressing one, which is troubling us all now that we're pretty well through with the Vietnam War, is inflation and what's happening to the cost of living, especially food prices, as food represents in most American families a fifth to a quarter of the total family budget. They are absolutely unacceptable increases, and we really should be controlling food prices right down to the production level. Now, the law doesn't do that right now. Hence, the next best thing that we can do is to give the consumer the best possible advice on the federal and the state level as to what he ought to buy and what he ought not to buy. And I believe that this could be very effective, as the consumer showed by their meat boycott. I'm going to do my best here in the Congress to get the government to do that and also to pass the bill for a consumer protection agency, which I think is more important than ever. One other point which is very important. Our state AFL-CIO has met recently, and it epitomized the fact, I spoke before them, it epitomized the fact that labor has been quite restrained about the way it's been handling the wage and salary situation. Now, the temptation would be for labor to say, well, we got to get ours, and if there's going to be a big inflation, and there certainly is. That, I think, would be very superficial. And I hope very much that the statesmanship of labor continues generally to hold its line. That doesn't mean no increases. It means trying to adopt a moderate course, because if labor should take the bit in its teeth, then we are in not only for inflation, which we already have, but a national disaster. While if it doesn't do that, I think we have a chance here in the Congress to turn the situation around within the next couple of months so as to stabilize materially the price situation and correct the runaway inflation in respect of food prices. Just a comment upon one or two other issues about which people are thinking. The president is vetoing, as you know, or has vetoed by now, the bill for a minimum wage. It's a moderate bill. It's a humanitarian bill. I regret very much that it's been done. I think one of the main causes is the inflexibility of the administration on the so-called youth differential. That is the effort to hire at a lower than the minimum wage youth in respect of employment, and the danger is it will displace older people. I pledge my utmost efforts to get a minimum wage bill. This is an elementary and essential reform. Another subject, most people are worried about Watergate and the Watergate tapes, etc., and what it's going to do to our government. It's not going to dismantle the United States, but it needs to be investigated to the very end, and the success of our democracy has to be demonstrated in the fact that nobody is above the law, including the President of the United States. And therefore, I hope the President makes it crystal clear, because I think he owes that to the country, that whatever the Supreme Court decides on these tapes, he's going to comply with. I think whatever may be his theoretical rights in respect of presidential prerogative or executive privilege, they should not be invoked in view of the fact that the country needs the confidence in the presidency, let alone the particular man who's president or woman in the presidency of the United States, which will be engendered by his obeying a Supreme Court order. The last point I'd like to comment on is the designation of Henry Kissinger to be Secretary of State to replace Secretary Rogers. I think that's auspicious for our country and the world in terms of peace and security. It will consolidate the authority in the hands of the one man in foreign policy who's been the most brilliant innovator and in whom the president has such great confidence. Now, I have two distinguished journalists from our state to ask me some questions today. One is Roland Powell of the Buffalo Evening News, and the other is John Omasinski of the Gannett News Service. And now, gentlemen, who has the first question? I believe you have, John. Right.
I'm wondering if you see a time in the nation's economy when controls will be no longer needed, when I think essentially what I'm asking is our economy chronically ill.
Is our economy chronically geared to controls, really, John, is what you're asking? I don't think that's true. I don't think we will always have controls. I don't think that that's of this kind. There are lots of regulations and controls, utility rates, antitrust laws, all kinds of things. And there are many businesses we give subsidies to, including farm and farm products. But the important point is that we will have a freer economy. But we cannot be afraid of the controls. And we cannot be constantly talking about controls in terms of, well, don't worry about them, they'll be off tomorrow. Because this is what shakes the confidence of the people in the determination of the government to keep the price of living stable. And therefore, I hope that while we have the controls, we will not compromise them by promises which we know we can't keep in the immediate future.
Just to clarify the legislative picture on these controls, what keeps the Congress itself from voting food controls?
The Congress itself could do so. It has not done so. The reason is that there's danger of scarcity and shortage. The argument has been that farmers won't produce if there are food price controls. But I think that our people have to run that risk. That's why I speak of consumer discipline. We have to run a risk that we'll at last get abreast of what seems to be a situation which has no end. It doesn't do the farmer any good. It just creates an enormously dissatisfied public, and it certainly hurts our country's economic system. So, and I'm sure whatever food price controls were affixed would be very fair. No one has any desire to sweat the farmer or abuse him or prejudice him. So I really believe that this is a necessary way to stop an impossible situation.
On this minimum wage that you just discussed, right, Senator, do you see any possibility that there'll be more accommodation between the president and Congress now that you're back after this recent?
I think that there ought to be. You know, I feel very strongly about his vetoes. I believe there are too many vetoes. I believe there's too much confrontation. I believe there ought to be much more effort to get together with the Congress. We've had some signal examples of that. We got together on a bill for the aged. Material modifications were made here, in which I was a party, and the bill passed and the president signed it. We ought to do the same on minimum wage. We ought to do the same on manpower training. We ought to do the same, if humanly possible, even on war powers. The big act, which I'm the author of, and which will at long last put the power to go to war or not to go to war, not just in the hands of the president, but in the hands of the Congress and the president. So I would urge the president, I'm doing that currently, to try more and more to work by agreement with us. Let us have some of those all-night bargaining sessions in which so many collective bargaining agreements are made, but let's have them between Congress and the administration, and the people will be the beneficiaries.
The president is sending up what he called a new State of the Union message, somewhat narrower than the earlier one. What, in your view, has to be handled, done by Congress this year, not just in this particular Congress, but by the end of this year, outside of the appropriation bills?
Well, the appropriation bills are elementary. I think pension and welfare reform is very essential, because this involves half the American workforce and $150 billion in resources, and the hopes for ultimate security by the American people. Again, it's a bill which I author with Senator Williams, the chairman of the Labor Committee, and I'm very hopeful we can get it made into law. I believe very much that we may have to take further action on inflation, respecting rents, perhaps even respecting interest rates, which are also soaring out of sight, and respecting food prices, which we discussed a minute ago. Other measures which I believe need to be taken are measures relating to manpower training and public service jobs. I believe also we ought to regularize, if we can, and do much better by the workmen's compensation system and the unemployment compensation system, both of which have very grave deficiencies. Those are, I believe, the critical measures. There are others in the foreign policy field I'd love to see acted on very urgently, like the genocide treaty, which has been slumbering around for 25 years, and it's high time that this fundamental act of humanity is passed. Also, the president may come along with further agreements on nuclear weapons and other things in which we're negotiating internationally. Again, those will have to have the highest priority. I'm sure I've left out a good many, but I've tried in the time we have available to give something of a coloration of where I think the biggest emphasis has to be, and I deeply feel that it has to be on the economic side. And also, if there is a remote, even a remote chance, on a world economic agreement respecting money, in which we're in terrible trouble throughout the world with grave danger of a world depression if that situation really goes wrong, as it has every possibility of going.
Senator, if I could turn the subject to Watergate, how will you vote, if it comes to a vote, on this resolution to end the Watergate hearings that Senator Dole is planning to introduce?
I will not. I will vote against it. I believe that Watergate has to be examined to the end, no matter whom it affects. I think this is a fundamental moral issue of our government. And by the way, it raises in question all campaign practices and campaign contributions. And I forgot to list among what I considered urgent measures, reform of campaign financing and the way in which campaigns are run. As far as I'm concerned, as a senator from our state, I do not believe that I can remotely support the idea that anything goes in politics. You've got to be decent and moral to deserve to be a servant of the people, and we've got to enforce it by law. And that's what Watergate's all about.